I will collect and assemble all of the foreign Gentile nations together. And I will bring them down, lowering them and prostrating them towards the valley of Jehoshaphat, the place where Yahweh executes judgment. Then I will render judgment against them. There and then, concerning and on behalf of my people, my family, and my nation, and on behalf of my inheritance, the property I gave as a gift to Yisrael, to those individuals who engage and endure with God, which they have scattered and dispersed among the nations, having divided, apportioned, and distributed the rights to my land. Whoa!
Okay. Don't mess with his place.
Man, is there any nation on earth that's saying that a two-state solution is the wrong way to go? Is there any nation on earth that's saying, wait a minute, God gave Israel to the Israelites, and we ought not encourage terrorists to be given what was given by God?
Yeah. Who gave you the right to steal something and give it to somebody else?
Right.
I mean, who are you? Even if you didn't like the deal, who gave you the right to go?
But I want you to name a Gentile nation that is wholly and universally opposed to the people, the mythical people known as the Palestinians, and is wholly and completely in support of Israel.
Doesn't exist.
There isn't one, is there?
And it won't exist.
No, and you're certainly not going to find the Christian church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Pope, scumbag that he is, Bergoglio, went over there and spent all that time with the mythical people known as the Palestinians and supported their carving out their nation out of the heart of Judea and Samaria. And, you know, there's Christian denominations upon denominations, the Presbyterians leading the way, that want to boycott Israel in favor of these terrorists, these Philistines.
Yeah.
And so that's why every Gentile nation is going to be judged. And they're going to be judged on this criteria. You know, God finds it despicable that we treat one another so harshly, why we're so murderous and vicious. And that's why God perpetrated the flood. And it's why he's returning, because if he didn't return, man's governmental and military viciousness would wipe out all life on earth. But what God really cares about is his people. He cares about his place, Israel, and his people, Israel. That's what he cares about. And so when man arrogantly, viciously, militaristically, politically, religiously tries to divide up and give away, separating his people from his land and giving his land to other people, God's going to hold those people accountable, which would be every Gentile nation on earth.
Well, to me, if Yahweh wants to chastise his children, he does it himself. He don't ask you to do it.
No.
He's got a plan. He don't need your help.
And since the inheritance of the land is central to the covenant,
mm-hmm.
if you are opposed to Yahweh's gift to his children, it's like saying God doesn't have the right to give that which he created. To the people he chose. And understand that what the land stands for. The land is synonymous with Eden,
mm-hmm.
which is synonymous with God's home,
mm-hmm.
which is synonymous with heaven, which is synonymous with the destination of the seven Moed Mikre, Sukkah.
Yeah. Zion, the
right.
signpost.
Right. It is the Shabbat Eretz. You know what Shabbat means? Seven and promise. Seven and promise. He's going to tell us here that this is the Shabbat Eretz, that the land of seven, the land of promise. What's the seventh step along the way to God?
Sukkah.
Doesn't Sukkah mean tabernacle, speaking of God's home?
Sure. Seventh day, the 7,000.
Where did Yahweh have his tabernacle?
in Israel?
Mount Moriah, right in the middle of Jerusalem,
oh,
and Israel, right? Well, that's it. This is Mount Moriah, Jerusalem, Yehuda, Israel.
Right.
The land, Sukkah. The land, Shabbat. The land of promise, the land of seven. Sukkah, Israel, Eden are all synonymous. It's Yahweh's promise. It is what he gave to his covenant children. And man has no authority to take it away. And if you want to put yourself in opposition to God, there's nothing you can do that will irritate him more than you trying to sever the gift that he has provided, the benefit that he has provided to his people. That's it. And, you know, you mentioned that that this statement is taking place in a Yobel year, because he says that the possession is going to be returned and the slaves are going to be liberated. It takes place in a Yobel year. Yobel is seven sevens.
Yes.
So that is what he's talking about here. And every Gentile nation on earth is going to be condemned, judged, found guilty for separating the Israelites from the land and then dividing up the land, apportioning it and distributing it. What does the United States want to do? It wants to draw a line in the sand and say, this part is the Palestinians. You take it, cut it out of Israel. They even want to give East Jerusalem to the Islamic terrorists. That's what the United States wants to do. It's what Europe wants to do. The Muslims, of course, want to take the whole thing. What right do we have to do that? That's what God is saying. Don't do that. And also, for my people, who they have cast away, tossing aside, apportioning and allotting, even giving away and trading the boys with the whore, with the fat, unfaithful, wanton adulterers, and the girls whom they have sold and given up for the intoxicating wine which they have experienced and consumed. We cargo and in people. We make merchandise of men. The slave trade has never been more prolific than it is today, particularly with the influence of Islam. But it's huge in the slave trade. It's huge in the United States.
Oh, God.
And this whore?
Mexico and the deal. Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, the whore is Astarte, the Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, Virgin and Child. That is the whore of Babylon. They are one and the same. So then, therefore, what are you to me? What are you to me? You're going to try to take away what I've given Israel? You're going to try to thwart my covenant? You're going to try to negate my promise? What are you to me? Sore, Tyre, the Phoenician coastal town, which means to besiege and to bind in adversarial form, to assault and to confine with hostility. That would be in Lebanon now. And Sidon, a Phoenician coastal town from Sud, making a game out of hunting. That means killing for sport.
Sport, yeah.
And all of the entirety of the territory and the regions of those wallowing in the dung, the Galath of Peleth. Who are you to me? Those wallowing in the dung of Palestine. Who are you to me? Those of you up in Lebanon that besiege in adversarial form, that assault and confine with hostility. Look at Hezbollah in Lebanon attacking Israel. Who are you to me that make a game out of killing, of jihad? Particularly those wallowing in the dung of what Palestine represents. And you're nothing to me. I'm going to judge you and do away with you.
There's nothing unclear here, is it?
No. What is deserved? What's appropriate, God is asking? And what's to be done in recompense and retribution regarding you paying me back? Completely fulfilling your obligation to me. What you stole, what I gave. You stole what I created. You took my people. You abused them. You enslaved them.
What's deserved? What's appropriate as a consequence for what you have done? So whenever and whatever attempt you make to provide payment and retribution to me, I will swiftly and hastily return what you deserve based upon what you have done, because it is the retribution you have earned upon your own head, especially upon your leaders.
There's another reference to the two fates.
I don't know if God could be any more direct. This is what you have done. So he's asking, what do you deserve? What's the compensation? What's the retribution for abusing my people, from displacing my people from the land I gave them, for apportioning my people as if it was yours, land, to divide? Now, what on earth is the proper penalty, consequence, recompense for that? And then when you attempt, once you are bowed down before me in judgment, to say, okay, you know, we'll give it back, God's going to say, yeah, right. Here's what you deserve.
We take it back.
Yeah, here's what you deserve. Right on your rosh, on your leaders. By the way, it's interesting to say that, you know, God tells us that the prayer of somebody who is a Torahless has dung all over their face.
Uh-huh.
And so he sees those who are Torahless who pray to him as they're covered in dung.
Uh-huh.
And these people are wallowing in the dung of Palestine.
Yeah. Got that right away.
Oh, so Joel... 4:1-4 is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Now there are a fair amount of things that are known about, now that we know what the Philistines are. There's a fair amount of things that are known about Astarte. Astarte was the thing that God said, if you walk away from, I will deliver you. I will save you from the invasive militaristic nation that doesn't belong, the foreigner that acts so cruelly and viciously. So there's actually a fair amount that is known about Astarte. That's the thing we're asked to leave. Literally thousands of inscriptions depicting her title. Countless idols scribed with her name. Hundreds of temples erected in her honor. The Canaanites and Phoenicians worshipped Astarte,
mm-hmm,
as the horned goddess of fertility, of sexuality and warfare. In Persia, she was the horned goddess of love and fortune, especially in war. In Egypt, she was depicted as the Sphinx. You know the Sphinx is Astarte?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No.
In Babylon, she took the form of the winged lion. Her other symbols included a star within a circle. Isn't that the symbol of the U.S. Army?
It's on every airplane in World War II.
Yeah. No? The crescent moon. Well, there's a religion that chose that as their symbol, isn't there?
Yeah, that's an easy one.
Yeah. It's the fish. Well, there's a religion that uses the fish as their symbol. They call it an ichthus. You see it on bumper stickers of the idiots that have been duped by it. And, of course, as the dove. She was deified as the evening star, known as Venus. Astarte. Statuary and frescoes were most always in the naked form, and she became the model figurehead on the bows of sailing ships. She is shown throughout antiquity as a five-pointed star. That's the American star.
Mm-hmm.
Because five is the pentagram form, which is five in the Torah, mm-hmm, is the number of confusion. It represents Hasatan.
And we got 50 of them.
Yeah, we got 50 of them. Five times 10 of these stars. We're really into it.
Yeah.
Yep. She was known in antiquity as a rose, the rosary. And as I've mentioned, one of her primary symbols was that of a fish. The sign of the mother goddess was drawn as two opposing crescent moons. That's how they got the fish, to represent the female genitalia. And it was later appropriated by Roman Catholics to depict their new religion and called an ichthus. The symbol is common. And by the way, they knew that they were appropriating the pagan symbol at the time they were doing it.
Well, I think everything I've ever read, they know it and they incorporate it in order to draw in another crowd.
Yep.
You know, it's all about bringing all that, bringing in the flock.
Right, making people comfortable so that you can control them by incorporating their religion into your religion. She was known as the golden calf in Egypt, mm-hmm. with a sun disk overhead. So she's found throughout Egypt. In fact, the first statue that the Israelites built on their and once they reached Mount Horeb was a golden calf. That's Astarte. So this is who they are worshiping. However, knowing that Astarte was venerated by their religious ancestors throughout Israel, it's interesting that the Masoretes edited the name of the whore, implying that Bosheth, abomination, should be read in its place. It's just like they wrote Adonai every place that there was Yod Heh Wah Heh, so that you would read my Lord instead of Yahweh.
Oh.
Well, here they changed the name to Asheroth based on Bosheth when Yahweh actually wrote Astarte. It's from Astarte, and which became Ishtar. It's the basis of the golden calf.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. She is the whore of Babylon.
Yeah.
By the time she became Aphrodite and Venus, her attributes included love and marriage, beauty and happiness, laughter and pleasure, in addition to victory at war. Early Roman Catholics taught that Aphrodite embodied the conjugal love, which was the had its origin in the conjunction of the Lord and his church.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how you get the nuns.
Satan, And by the way, the nun, the word, is a translates fish and is derived from the image of Astarte. And the rose, which was her symbol, became the basis of the rosary, a tribute to the same Mother Earth, Mother Goddess. Her holiest festival was actually called Astarte. Easter, ready-made counterfeit for Roman Catholics. They didn't have to change the name. They didn't even have to change the dates. They didn't have to change the purpose. They just Christianized it, even bringing along with it the Easter eggs, Easter bunny, Easter ham, and Easter cakes.
Well, you got to have the ham so you get off the Tammuz.
Yeah. So after all, the whore was a fertility goddess, which is why you have a bunny laying eggs.
Everything is, yeah.
Yep. Moreover, like the Christian Jesus,
they were round circles. They were this to the sun god too. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. By the way, Astarte, Ishtar, she remained dead for 3 days. This is a god that died.
Yeah.
Went down to the underworld for three nights before being resurrected. Consistent also with the Babylonian worship of Tammuz, who was Ishtar's son, by the way of the Lord Bel. And then, of course, after being impregnated by the supreme sun god, we have the nativity of Ishtar's son, celebrated 9 months later on December 25th, providing Christendom with a pre-existing pagan celebration upon which to base their Christmas. The festival of Ishtar in the middle of August coincides with the Roman Catholic feast of the Assumption of Mary.
But that ain't what it means to me.
We're going to read these Israelites celebrating all of these Ishtar Easter festivals and getting their whole family involved in the celebration of Easter. And God doesn't say that, I know this is not what it means to you, so you're okay.
Yeah.
God says, I'm going to see to it that that your foes destroy you because what you're doing is despicable.
Yeah.
So the old line, that's not what it means to me, don't matter.
No.
Doesn't matter. So quite simply stated, Astarte, Astarte, Ishtar, Isis, Aphrodite, Venus, India, Diana, Mary, as the Blessed Virgin, Madonna and Child, Mother of God, Queen in Heaven, Lady of the Rosary, Hearer of Petitions, and the Lady of Biblos, the Lady of the Bible, provided the unifying fable for the religions of the Sumerians, Philistines, Canaanites, Egyptians, Babylonians, Assyrians, Phoenicians, Syrians, Persians, Indians, Greeks, Romans, Carthaginians, and Cypriots. And today, the Whore of Babylon reigns supreme in Christianity. embodying all of her former myths, including serving as the basis for Easter Sunday and Christmas. Yahweh could not have chosen a more revealing character to portray the nature of religious deception, especially how each successive religion co-opts aspects of its predecessors in order to appeal to the masses. One of the most common and spellbinding themes among the world's religions revolves around Astarte, Ishtar, including her names, her titles, her symbols, her rituals, and her festivals, all of which were born and bred in Babylon. She is the whore of Babylon.
Yeah.
I suppose that's why Yahweh condemns the myth of Astarte, Ishtar, Mary as the mother of God in Jeremiah, in conjunction with his mockery of the Easter rituals and the Christmas tree that her veneration inspired. It is also in that same book that Yahweh impugns the greatest Christian lie of all, that there is a renewed covenant and thus a divinely inspired New Testament. But we're at least a week away from turning to Jeremiah to understand it. But we'll get there. Now, none of this stopped Pauline Christianity from doing what the goddess's name actually conveys. If you look at in Hebrew and you look up the basis of Astarte, Ashar and Ashara,
right,
it means to become rich by increasing the flock while taking a tithe.
Taking a tithe. And and that's so dear to God's heart.
Oh, my. Even in America, the five-pointed pentagram conveying satanic overtures, so the five-point stars, which adorn the U.S. flag, as you pointed out, 50 of them, were first used throughout the ancient world to venerate the goddess and were known as the Star of Ishtar. Combining this with her crescent moon, we find the origin and symbol of Islam. Further, in Islam Quran, it offers more references and tributes to Mary than does the Christian New Testament.
Really?
Oh, far more.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this whole chapter is devoted. Do they call her Miriam, which was closer to her actual name? But, she's constantly the presented as the great mother in the Quran. Or Babylon's influence continues to be pervasive. Two most widely practiced religions in the world, both with her. In fact, if you were to combine socialist secular humanism with its love of Mother Earth, then you've got all three.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow.
So it's it is extraordinary how enveloped her mythology is.
I mean, just I don't get it.
Astarte's universal became a universal substitute, albeit bastardized for human appeal for what Yahweh and the set-apart spirit actually represent. She is a counterfeit of those things. In pagan mythology, she was called the ruler of the heavens, the queen of heaven, the shining one, the mother of all deities, the leader of hosts, the possessor of the tablets of life's records. That's where she models Mary, who's supposed to be in purgatory, and she can shorten the stay and comfort those in purgatory. The great mother, the great goddess, the light of the world, the producer of life, the creator of the people, the guardian of the law, the righteous judge, the forgiver of sins, the lawgiver, the mother of war, the goddess of victory, the source of prophecy, the lady of vision, the lady of heaven and earth, who receives our prayers. So many Christians pray to Mary.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm brought up in a Christian world or whatever world of religion, and I'm indoctrinated as a small child, I have a hard time ever getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I was brought up in a world in Israel, and I wasn't, what would attract me to these neighbors and their religion? Was it just the sex in the temple?
That's why you have to realize that there was a lot of sex in the temple, clearly. But it's also
a little bit,
what attracts people today to Christianity? I mean, Christianity is so obviously untrue. Paul was so clearly insane. and his writing so contradictory. What attracts people to it today? It's that the lie has become pervasive, and those in authority make it very difficult for anyone to bow their back and go against the crowd. And throughout human history, if you were to be one of the people that took a stand, bowed your back, went in the opposite direction, you were ostracized.
Sure.
You couldn't engage in business. Your children would be mocked. You know, you were ostracized, and often, like during the about 1,000 years of the reign of Roman Catholicism, you weren't just killed; you were tortured and publicly humiliated for questioning the authority of the lie and the liars. So that's why a lot of people go along. But what you find is that Yahweh does not impose himself. Yahweh says, "Here I am. This is what I'll do. This is what I'm offering. This is what I expect from you. If you meet these conditions, I will do the following things." And then he provides testimony every which way to say this is the consequence of making a bad choice in this regard. And this is how you resolve making a bad choice in this regard. And so Yahweh isn't braggadocious. He isn't imposing. He isn't compelling. He just simply says, "I'm going to lay it out for you, and it's your choice. Man's way or my way." So the vast majority of people have chosen man's way.
But these people were living during the days of Samuel,
mm-hmm.
and they knew all this. They knew the Torah.
Well, would you think that Samuel's ability to share the insights of the Torah were any more convincing than you and I, having the whole Torah at our disposal, having all these lexicons to study all of these words and to be able to examine it letter by letter? What did they know that we don't know? We have Samuel's testimony, and we have all of Yahweh's prophecy on top of it, and we can read the Torah that he delivered ourselves. What did they have that we don't have?
And then it's still not compelling enough.
Right. I have a lot of friends
grew
that
up the whole time and didn't know about the Moabites and the Philistia and all. What drew them away?
Well,
it seems like they go one generation and they're at it again.
I'm asked a lot. You know, people making statements. You know, it's hard to imagine a people who were brought out of Egypt after being slaves there for 400 years, and to see the mightiest military on earth drowned as they walk across the Gulf of Aqaba land bridge across the Red Sea, and that they are provided for, given this divine revelation by Yahweh himself, and why they would so quickly turn. And they did.
Yeah.
But that's human nature. You know, we were given a choice. Yahweh is not imposing, my response is that I'm convinced that our opportunity to know and experience Yahweh and to understand what he's offering is far greater right now than it was for them even during the Exodus.
Yeah.
I do not feel in any way, shape, or form
shortchanged. No,
the shortchanged. If you were to give me the opportunity to go back then and be part of the Exodus, even to walk up Mount Horeb with Moshe to receive the Torah, and what we have the opportunity to do by searching the whole of the Torah prophets and Psalms and compare the predictions to human history and to analyze these connections with the tools that we have today, we're in a far better position.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah, it's probably just rhetorical. I just don't get somebody who grew up in Israel and then could be that tempted by. I mean, I can understand a few. I just blows me away every time I think about it. Now, I understand slaves coming out of Egypt. They grew up around a Satanistic world,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then came out and they were uneducated and everything else. So, I mean, they had a lot of reasons why you could build a case for.
Yahweh asked them to wipe out the host of this disease when they came into the promised land, but they wouldn't do it.
No.
Ishtar was also the perfect guise for Satan in yet another way. She paved the way for socialist secular humanism and its duplicitous moral code of political correctness. Estard advanced an irrational and immoral mantra, whereby wrong was considered right, good was bad, delusion was correct. The goddess was the embodiment of dualities, of love and hate, life and death, truth and lies, light and darkness, peace and war, happiness and sadness, good and bad. She was said to embrace these opposite positions simultaneously, a trait she shares with today's enlightened and progressive social, academic, and political mandates. But as such, she was temperamental and ferocious, and her unpredictable duplicity invoked considerable fear. She was as duplicitous as the politically correct mantra, "We are intolerant of intolerance."